Cain crossed a field, then entered the city, his dark clothing blending with the night. The dim passageways between the houses seemed to hold danger in every shadow. He tensed with anticipation, his teeth clenched, waiting for an Indian to glance out a window and then raise an alarm. He saw no one in the side lanes or even on the main thoroughfare. The houses were deserted, but Cain refused to relax. He kept his eyes on the towering edifice of the pyramid, noting how a fire flickered near it, staining the cloudy sky with orange. The drumming went on, now overlaid with a chant. Peering around the corner of a house, he saw a procession of Indians scaling the long stairway that stretched to the top of the pyramid. They took up stiff-backed positions on either side of the steps, each holding an unlit torch. A man carrying a sparking firepot moved to each in turn, and they thrust the pitch-coated ends of their torches into the pot to set them aflame. Cain had no idea what the people were doing or why, but their presence on the steps explained the absence of activity in the city streets. Moving in fits and starts, he circled around to the rear of the immense structure, belly crawling into the mouth of another alley. He reached a wall encircling the grounds of the pyramid and straightened up for a quick look on the other side. From an arch in the base of the pyramid emerged six figures wearing long blue mantles that draped their bodies from throat to ankle. Their faces and heads were concealed by monstrous serpentine masks. From their crests floated colorful plumes of feathers. The man in the lead carried a staff that supported a grinning human skull. Cain watched as the shamans began to climb a small series of stairs set into the pyramid, moving at a measured, ritualistic pace. He slid between the double gates in the wall and rushed toward the last man in line. Cain counted on the drums and the headpiece to mute the sounds of his rapid approach. The man's peripheral vision was impaired by the mask, so he had no idea who belonged to the arm that cinched tight around his throat and yanked him backward. The man struggled, but couldn't get air to shout. Thrusting out a leg, Cain swept the Indian's legs out from under him and slammed him painfully to the paving stones. Cain deprived him of further oxygen by knee-dropping his entire weight onto his diaphragm. As the Indian convulsed, Cain snatched off the headpiece, revealing the swarthy face of a man in middle age. He was almost unconscious, lips writhing over discolored teeth. Cain recognized him as the shaman Cloudminder, as he leaned close to jab the last of the drugged darts into his jugular vein. Whipping off the blue cloak, he drew it around his shoulders and quickly tied the thongs around his neck. He placed the mask over his head, wrinkling his nose at the odor of stale sweat and the ripe scent of breadfruit. He had difficulty seeing out of the eye holes, but managed to reach the steps without stumbling. The figure ahead of him turned his head awkwardly toward him as if asking a silent question. Not to do what was expected would arouse instant suspicion, so he lengthened his stride, falling in three steps behind the man. By the time they reached the top of the pyramid and entered into the stone-ceilinged ceremonial room, Cain's lungs labored for air inside the stuffy headpiece, and the tendons at the back of his knees ached. Without being too obvious about it, he stared with interest at the pillar carvings, the little idols, and in particular, at the huge metal bowl. The shaman with the skull staff made a gesture, and Cain's companions took from stone shelves small discs of metal. They passed them around, a pair to a man. Cain held them uncertainly, watching the others. When they began to strike them together, setting up a nerve-stinging racket, he followed suit, trying to match their rhythm. He was far too apprehensive to feel foolish. He remained beside the bowl, his left arm occasionally brushing it. He felt movement in the metal, and at first he attributed it to sympathetic vibrations caused by the clashing of the cymbals. But as the minutes wore on, the movement inside the bowl became more frequent, completely out of sync with the noise. With a sinking sensation in the pit of his belly, Cain realized there was something alive within it, something big and anxious to get out. He took a surreptitious sideways step away from it. At that moment, an incongruous shape appeared on the opposite side of the temple, rising from the stairway. For a split second, Cain's heart thudded in instinctive fear. Then he recognized King Chak, decked out in an elaborate costume made of cured snakeskin and feathers. A group of people followed King Chak to the top. Young men, their naked bodies decorated with spots and whorls of blue paint, half carried a diminutive girl between them. Domi's nude body was covered in blue paint, and if not for her white hair and half-closed crimson eyes, Cain would not have been able to identify her. Her head wobbled drunkenly, and she breathed in great gasps, gazing around with unfocused eyes. Cain clenched his teeth, but did nothing except to crash his cymbals together. A few seconds later, Grant stepped forward, surrounded by a bevy of Indian maidens. He wasn't naked, although his female escorts were, but he didn't look particularly happy about it. In fact, his eyes were narrowed to slits. Sweat glistened on his dark face as if he struggled to break invisible chains. Both people were obviously under the influence of some drug, but the extent of its effects was determined by their individual physiques and metabolisms. Domi, small and childlike, appeared to be only semi-conscious, while Grant reminded Kane of a man just roused from slumber, still groggy and disoriented, requiring only the proper stimulus to come to full wakefulness. King Chak faced Domi, smiled kindly, and gestured to the massive bowl behind him. Eardrums still recovering from the racket of the cymbals, Kane thought he heard a rasping, scraping sound from within it. Four of the six masked men put their cymbals on the floor and grasped the lid of the bowl by small, almost invisible niches. On impulse, Kane handed his cymbals to the man next to him and moved toward Domi, waving back the young men around her. Though they looked at him questioningly, they obeyed his gesture, and Kane stepped behind her, grasping her bare shoulders. The wet paint on her body slid beneath his fingertips. Lowering his head, Kane hoped to hell she was alert enough to understand him.
When I give the signal, move.
Huh?
Before he could repeat himself, the masked priests heaved up the lid of the bowl and lifted it away. With a mounting fear, Kane noticed how everyone in the temple seemed frozen by the soft, dry rustling from within its concave interior. Even through the mask, he smelled a fetid, dank odor. Cold sweat beaded his face and trickled into his eyes as a vague form reared upright from the bowl, swaying slightly. Yellow eyes flamed in the indirect torchlight, and Kane saw the huge, wedge-shaped head. From it flowed a crest of fluttering feathers. King Chak gazed at the beast, his eyes worshipful. Kane had seen only a few muti animals in his life. Most recently, he had encountered, and nearly been killed by, the legendary Ouroboros obscura, the huge sandworm of the desert wastes. The muti animals, spawned by the aftermath of the Nukost that tended toward gigantism, had very short lifespans and were virtually extinct by the time Kane was born. The serpent rearing up from the bowl exceeded all of his notions about reptilian development, mutated or not. He had no idea of the creature's true length, but at least 12 feet of it was visible. The diameter of the scaled, barrel-shaped body was twice that of his torso. Its triangular head was as large as that of a horse. A forked tongue slithered in and out of its mouth. In the torchlight, Kukul Khan's mottled scales glistened like a coating of molten metal. Kane knew that snakes were essentially deaf, but they were exceptionally sensitive to vibrations. The crashing of the cymbals reverberated through the metal of the bowl and roused the giant serpent, and probably aroused its temper as well. Kukul Khan's gleaming eyes fixed upon Domi. Although Kane told himself the snake was just an animal, he couldn't help but detect an ancient and certain evil in those unblinking eyes. The monstrous snake arched its neck and swayed back and forth hypnotically. As it did, Kane saw that the feathered plumes upon its spade-shaped head were artificial adornments fastened by thin straps. The fakery did not make him feel better. His belly still turned cold flip-flops of revulsion and denial. All of the people in the temple fell to their knees except for King Chak, Domi, Kane, and Grant. Chak reached for Domi, grasping her by the hands and tugging her forward. Kane tightened his grip on Domi's shoulders and pulled her backward.
Now!
Chak stumbled and scowled in angry confusion as Domi's pink slick hands slid through his fingers. Pivoting at the waist, Kane lifted Domi completely from the floor and pushed her into Grant's arms. He spun back around and backfisted Chak across the chin. The king staggered and fell almost directly beneath the elevated bowl. The snake's eyes fixed on Kane, its attention attracted by the fact he was the nearest human still standing erect. Beneath the folds of the mantle, he unholstered his sin-eater just as the serpent's massive head darted out and down toward him. Its jaws opened with a loud pop, actually dislocated, so as to be able to fit Kane's head and shoulders into its mouth. He caught a glimpse of the double rows of slanting fangs lining the creature's upper and lower jaws as he leapt to the right, struggling to fling back the cloak and bring his blaster to bear. Kukul Khan's blunt snout drove like an arrow into his flapping mantle, the cloth snagging on the needle-tipped teeth. The snake instantly whipped its head back, snapping its jaws shut. Kane tried to resist the drag, but he was jerked forward, the knotted leather thongs biting cruelly into his throat. He struggled to untie the knots, but with the strain on the mantle, he couldn't secure a grip. The headpiece wobbled and slid askew, obstructing his vision. Boots sliding across the stone floor, blind and gagging, Kane raised his sin-eater and depressed the trigger in the general vicinity of the snake's head. Kukulkan flailed its head back and forth, trying to free its teeth of the unappetizing mantle. Kane was tossed to and fro, feeling like a rat caught in the jaws of a terrier. His toes scrabbled on the stone floor as he clawed at the rawhide thongs sinking into his windpipe, but he couldn't fit his fingers between the knots and his neck. Desperately, he groped for his combat knife in its boot sheath. After two tries, he touched the release button and drew it from the scabbard. Attempting to slice through the leather tie thongs would more than likely result in a severed artery, so he awkwardly slashed behind his head. The blade's razored edge cut through the mantle. The pressure on his larynx and windpipe decreased. The gargantuan serpent tore its fangs free of the cloak, and Kane caromed headlong against a stone pillar, colliding with a carved snake head. The wooden mask splintered upon impact, but it saved him from a fractured skull. Falling to the floor, Kane rolled frantically, dropping his knife as he tried to pull off the ruined headpiece and disentangle himself from the ragged mantle at the same time. He managed to toss off the shattered remains of the mask with a furious shake of his head. Neck arched, Kukulkan towered above him, shreds of cloak snagged on its fangs. Kane scooted backward on the seat of his pants until he was at the very edge of the temple. Raising his sin-eater, he tried to center the snake's bobbing head with the blaster's front blade sight.
No!
King Chak rose from the floor and dove toward him, reaching for the pistol. At that instant, Kukulkan's feathered head shot down and struck Chak between the shoulders. The blow knocked the king from his feet, flattening him with pile-driver force to the floor. The serpent's massive jaws closed on the back of his hooded head, the king's bones snapping and splintering. Kukulkan's gigantic, sinuous shape slithered out of the bowl, glistening coil after coil looping around Chak's body. Kane made a swift estimate that the monster's length was at least 50 feet. As the creature oozed out of the bowl, pandemonium exploded atop the temple. The Indians came to their feet, some charging pell-mell out of the temple and down the steps, trampling their fellows. A few others rushing toward where their feathered god squeezed their king to death, voicing mingled cries of terror as Kukulkan crushed the wrong sacrifice. A couple of the masked, mantled shamans dashed toward Kane, obsidian knife blades in their fists. The thick, muscled trunk of the snake looped out in a side arc and slammed into one of the priests, pitching him over the side of the pyramid. The other shaman grappled with Kane, slashing at him in a frenzy with his knife. Kane blocked the thrusts with his sin-eater. The obsidian blade snapped off near the hilt. Kane crashed the metal frame of the blaster against the man's mask, crushing the fragile wood and breaking the skull beneath it. As the man sagged, Kane cast a quick glance over his shoulder. Grant, with Domi enfolded in his arms, stared dazed and uncomprehending at the huge snake sliding its body around King Chak.
What the hell are you waiting for? Your turn?
Grant had watched all the proceedings from a safe remove, as emotionally distant as if he were observing a faintly ridiculous play staged for his amusement. Even when the masked priest revealed himself to be Kane, he still didn't get the point. He was particularly baffled when the feathered serpent god appeared to devour the feathered serpent man. He knew there was some deep symbolic meaning at hand, but it required too much effort to reason it out. Even the profane question Kane shouted at him seemed utterly irrelevant. He stood motionless as the flood tide of Indians screamed and swirled around him. He didn't move until one of the blue-robed, masked figures latched onto Domi and tried to wrest her from his arms. Grant refused to relinquish his grasp, and for a long moment, Domi was the object of a determined game of tug-of-war. A black-bladed knife appeared in the shaman's fist and bit into the meat of Grant's left shoulder, just above the armpit. It blazed with a searing pain, like an animal sinking fangs into his flesh. Galvanized by the burst of hot agony, Grant pistoned his right fist directly into the wooden snake head. The mask caved in at the point of impact, and the man catapulted backward, falling right into the snake's coils. Grant tore the knife from his shoulder with his right hand and glared around, breathing deeply through his nostrils.
What's going on?
Grant swiped a hand over his eyes, blinked, and watched Kane pistol-whipping one of the blue-mantled shamans. Ignoring the burning throb in his shoulder and the trickle of blood sliding down his left arm, Grant shook his head to clear it further.
Kane!
Keeping his eyes on the snake only a few feet away, Kane tore at the fastenings of the cloak.
Fight, goddammit!
Grant shoved the obsidian knife into Domi's hands and barreled into the fray, punching at the bodies hemming him in, striking with fists and feet, clearing a path to Kane. As he shouldered a man off the edge of the pyramid, he saw Kane's combat knife lying on the floor. He reached down and scooped it up. Kukulkan lifted its head from Chak and curved toward Kane again, jaws snapping. Kane triggered another tri-burst, but the giant serpent's head weaved with lightning swiftness, and only one round came close to finding a target, shearing off the tip of a feather. The hard, horned snout of Kukulkan rammed deep into Kane's midsection, lifting him off his feet and driving him against the stone column. Sour bile rushed up his throat. He was only dimly aware of collapsing to the floor in a heap, but he knew Kukulkan's open jaws hovered above him. Through the haze of pain swimming across his eyes, he caught a blurry impression of Grant bounding forward, combat knife raised. Kane forced himself to his knees. He wadded up the torn remnants of the cloak and shoved them into the creature's gaping maw. Kukulkan arched backward, head shaking furiously, trying to dislodge the choking mass of fabric in its throat. At that instant, Grant locked both arms around the snake's neck, just behind the thick knots of jaw muscles. The snake reared up, lifting him clear off the floor, rising to smash him against the ceiling. Grant's head slammed against the roof, and multicolored bursts flared behind his eyes. He strained and wrestled, stabbing with the knife, feeling the blade sink to the hilt through the tough scales. In a volcanic convulsion of contraction and expansion, the serpent thrashed, hissing in fury and pain. Its tail whiplashed against the base of a pillar with sledgehammer force, chips of stone flying from it, cracks running halfway up its length. Legs kicking empty air, Grant hung on to the knife handle, goring, ripping, working the blade through the shuddering, rippling bulk. He grabbed on tight to the leather straps holding the snake's feathered crest in place. Kukulkan stretched up again and once more slammed Grant into the ceiling. The impact sent shivers of pain from the crown of his head to the middle of his back, and his brain reeled with the punishment he was taking. Kneading his midsection, desperately trying to drag air into his lungs, Kane used the pillar at his back as a brace and pushed himself to his feet. When he saw the pattern of cracks Kukulkan's blow had riven into a support column, inspiration flashed into his mind. Before he could leap into action, Domi bounded nimbly over the lashing tip of the monster's tail. With a black-bladed knife in her hands, she slashed at Kukulkan's mottled hide, the glossy point scoring a bloody gash in the trunk. A muscled coil looped outward in an instantaneous reaction, bowling her backward. Arms windmilling, she would have fallen from the pyramid if Kane hadn't grabbed her. Her ruby eyes were glazed, but wide and wild with frightened confusion.
Help him!
Shooting at the serpent's body would have little effect, Kane figured. He could waste an entire clip trying to hit a vital organ or break its flexible vertebrae. Only a headshot would kill the creature, and with Grant still clinging tenaciously to the creature's whipsawing neck, he would be at as much risk of being shot as Kukulkan. Domi started to lunge forward again, but Kane restrained her with his left arm. He aimed the Sin Eater at the cracked pillar, flicked the selector to full auto, and depressed the trigger. The high-velocity 248-grain rounds tore across the temple and ripped savagely into the support post. The air filled with the jackhammering thunder and the sharp, sweet smell of cordite. A section of the post dissolved in sprays of dust and rock fragments. He shifted the barrel of the Sin Eater to the pillar at the far corner and emptied the remainder of the magazine at its base. When the firing pin clicked against the empty chamber, he ejected the spent clip and slapped another one home. Grant still clung to the creature's neck, hanging on like a bulldog to the hilt of the knife, which he could not withdraw.
What the fuck are you doing?
Let go of that damn thing!
Grant instantly obeyed, releasing his chokehold and falling to one knee, leaving the knife buried in Kukulkan's neck. The feathered headdress came with him, clenched in one fist. At the same microsecond, Kane let loose with another full-auto fusillade at the pillar. He played the bullet stream over it as if he were washing it down with a hose. Grant rolled frantically toward him, beneath the barrage, barely avoiding a vicious snap of the serpent's fangs. A couple of bullets tore into Kukulkan's body, destroying fistfuls of flesh and muscle amid sprays of dark blood. It tumbled backward, away from the barrage, hurling King Chok's crushed corpse from its coils. The rear portion of the temple's roof tilted, then crashed down. The entire pyramid seemed to tremble with the violence of the impact. The huge, multi-ton rock slab bisected Kukulkan's body, pinning it to the floor. The creature's trunk knotted, looped, unlooped, and whiplashed in crazed efforts to free itself. It turned to bite at the temple roof, its teeth breaking against the stone. Resting the barrel of his Sin Eater on his forearm, Kane held his breath and squeezed off one more round. Kukulkan's right eye broke apart in a gelid spray. It tossed its head back and forth, jaws opening and closing, forked tongue flailing as if it were trying to dislodge a bone stuck in its throat. The huge head drooped and fell to the temple floor. Postmortem spasms still rippled along the serpent's body. Domi, Grant, and Kane backed away to the lip of the temple, watching with stupefied eyes and listening to the agonized hisses and the thud and rasp of the snake's trunk against the floor as it convulsed in its death throes. For a long moment, no one moved or spoke. The Indians assembled below fell to their knees. They made no move to ascend the stairs, but only wailed and howled. As quickly as he could, Kane thumbed out the spent clip and inserted his last magazine.
Where are your blasters?
Grant shook his head and gingerly felt the stab wound in his shoulder.
Not sure. Maybe in one of the rooms down there.
Domi trembled violently, crossing her arms over her breasts, further smearing the paint, already running due to the sweat that had sprung from her pores.
What do we do now?
No choice but to brazen it out. Their king and god are dead, but they think you're something special, Domi. You'll have to go first. Don't show fear. Act like you own the place.
She hesitated. Then she drew in a deep, steadying breath and lifted her head at a defiant angle. With a regal, deliberate stride, Domi descended the pyramid. Grant and Kane followed, Kane keeping the sin-eater at his side. Eyes fixed on the foot of the steps far below, paying no heed to the babbling Amazonians, Domi led the two men to the base of the structure. The Indians parted at her approach, although some of them were openly weeping, others blank-faced with shock. The skin at the back of his neck crawled, but Kane resisted the impulse to look behind him. Despite all that had happened, he still did not want to chill any of the Indians unless they gave him no choice. At the foot of the steps, Domi paused, looking back and forth uncertainly for a few seconds before walking beneath an arched doorway. Inside the chamber where she and Grant had been bathed and further drugged, they found their clothes and weapons. While Kane watched the doorway, his two friends quickly dressed. Domi didn't bother to wash the paint from her body with the water still in the tubs. Neither she nor Grant thanked Kane for coming back for them. There was no need. They all knew each other well enough to make it unnecessary. Grant examined his stab wound.
Where's our medical kit?
Lost it on the trail.
Kane walked to his side. He grabbed Grant's left elbow and, ignoring the man's wordless glare of protest, pulled the arm up.
Does it hurt?
God damn it! Yes, it fucking hurts!
No muscles are cut. It'll mend.
Kiss my ass.
Grant pulled away. Domi slid into the shoulder rig for her .45 caliber Detonics Combat Master, unleathered it, and checked the action.
How could those nice people believe a muty snake was a god?
Nice people can believe in as many crazy things as bad people. Gods come in all shapes, I guess. And so do monsters.
Grant strapped his sin-eater to his right forearm, his expression grim.
We've got no choice but to try to make it back to the gateway tonight.
Yeah, it's a 3-hour walk. Probably longer because it's dark.
Why can't we stay here until sunrise? Hold them off here.
The longer we give the Indians to think about what happened, the more pissed off they'll get. They're in shock right now. That'll wear off.
He's right. Let's get the hell out of here.
As ready as they could possibly be, Kane, Domi, and Grant marched out of the room. The crowd that had assembled on the pyramid steps was gone, and they met no one as they walked to the main thoroughfare. Torches flared smokily at wide intervals. The few Amazonians on the street stood unspeaking, watching them pass with black eyes seething with a combination of hatred and fear. With great caution, Grant, Kane, and Domi neared the outskirts of the city. The fading silvery light of the setting moon imbued the night with surreal menace. They reached the fields unmolested, but none of the three relaxed. They crossed a small bridge over an irrigation ditch, and the solid forest wall of the jungle loomed before them. The trees were colossal, the spaces between them dark and quiet. Rather than seeming majestic, the vast rainforest looked haunted. Kane's imagination easily populated it with all manner of loathsome creatures, far worse than giant, muty snakes. They stuck to the path as it entered the jungle. At first, it seemed pitch dark beneath the towering trees, but their eyes adjusted to the gloom, and they were able to stay on the well-worn trail. From up ahead came the faint scent of a rushing stream. Suddenly, from all sides, darts whizzed toward them out of the darkness. Indians leapt from the shadowed foliage. Kane, Domi, and Grant immediately broke into a sprint.
God damn it!
Grant fired an indiscriminate burst over his shoulder, the barrel of the sin-eater smearing the murk with flickering flame. He heard the wet explosive impact as at least one bullet found a flesh-and-blood target.
Keep going. If anybody gets hit, sing out.
I can tell this is gonna be a long night.
Whenever Bridget Baptiste reviewed the events of the past year, she didn't know whether she was still alive through luck, divine intervention, or simply the proper application of skills to circumstances. She knew some of her survival skills were underdeveloped, so she walked forth from the sector with a blaster in her hand. Behind her, the mountain peak lifted gray stone crags and broken turrets to the blue mid-morning Montana sky. In front of her, on the far side of the plateau, the broad tarmac tumbled down into an abyss. The precipice dropped 1,000 feet. In a stream bed at the bottom rested a pile of rusted vehicles. The ragged remnants of a chain-link fence ran around the plateau. A single road curled down to the flatlands along the forested slopes of the Bitterroot Range. At one time, steel guardrails had bordered the rim of the plateau, but only a few rusted metal stanchions remained. Before he had made the jump to South America, Kane had erected a man-shaped and sized target between two of the stanchions and urged her to get in some practice with the gun he had chosen for her. She paced off 30 yards from the edge of the abyss. Bridget examined the Ivor Johnson TP-9 in her hands. The autoblaster was fairly small and lightweight, less than 26 ounces. Carefully, she clicked the ambidextrous safety switch to the off position. Her lack of true skill with firearms had been a point of contention between her and Kane for months. For a while, she had carried an H&K VP-70, then a Beretta, but she found the weight and recoil of both guns a little uncomfortable. She had opted for a .32 caliber Mauser at one point, but its range was limited and its accuracy unreliable. She carried an Uzi a time or two, but other than firing a few practice magazines, she never had used it in the field. Recently, Kane had recommended the Ivor Johnson. She assumed a combat stance, arms stretched out, pistol nestled snugly between both hands, legs planted wide and firmly. Impatiently, she tossed a wind-blown strand of sunset-colored hair from her face. For an instant, she thought about the incongruous picture she made, with her unruly mane of red-gold hair clubbed back, and wearing a white bodysuit, the duty uniform of the Cerberus personnel, she presented an unlikely image of a gun enthusiast. She squinted through wire-framed, rectangular-lensed eyeglasses. After the mission in the Western Isles, Bridget had devoted more thought than usual to her looks, about the effect her tall, willowy body had on men. She remembered how more than one male colleague in Cobaltville had made it obvious that he thought far more than she ever did about her full breasts, her feline slanted eyes of deepest, clearest emerald, her smoothly contoured cheekbones, lightly dusted with freckles. Apparently, Ambika, their most recent adversary, had devoted a considerable amount of thought to the effect her physical appearance might have on men, or one man in particular. Bridget brought the white outline of the human head into target acquisition. Kane had cautioned her repeatedly about the difficulty of scoring with headshots, pointing out that the body was bigger and even a non-lethal wound could be incapacitating, but she had her reasons for centering the TP-9's sights on the head. Holding her breath, she mentally superimposed the smirking face of Ambika over the featureless target and squeezed the trigger.
Die, you bitch queen. Die, you whore goddess.
The firing pin clicked on the empty chamber, and Bridget lowered the blaster. Fanning away the planes of cordite smoke, she peered toward the target and saw a number of ragged holes neatly grouped in the center of the face.
Regenerate that, muty slut.
She felt a flush of pride, then almost immediately a twinge of shame. As far as she knew, Ambika was truly dead, her mutagenic regenerative abilities notwithstanding. If the wounds she had incurred during the final bloody battle aboard her flagship hadn't been fatal, then the warrior queen had drowned when she pitched over the side. Regardless, Bridget wasn't convinced of Ambika's death, and although he hadn't spoken of it, she was sure Kane wasn't either. Nor was she at all certain that the possibility Ambika had survived didn't intrigue him more than just a bit. Bridget swallowed a sigh. She would never forget any of it. How Ambika had humiliated her by binding, gagging, and caging her, forcing her to watch as she and Kane made love. Or at least that had been Ambika's plan before Kane improvised one of his own.
La belle dame sans merci.
Hearing the scuff of footsteps on the asphalt behind her, she turned to see Banks and Auerbach climbing down from the slope on the opposite side of the plateau. Banks was a youthful black man with trimly blocked hair and bright alert eyes. Auerbach was considerably larger, a burly, freckled man with a red buzz cut. When Banks saw Bridget, he gave her a nod, but Auerbach paid her no attention, keeping his gaze fixed on the ground, studiously ignoring her. Bridget knew why, and reciprocated with the same lack of notice. He was returning from the grave of Bethlehem Rauch, and was in no mood to speak, even if she felt like engaging him in conversation, which she didn't. Dealing with Ambika's crazed jealousy was one thing, Bridget reflected. At least the bioengineered queen of the Western Isles had been straightforward about her designs on Cain. And although Ambika might still be alive, there was no doubt at all about Beth Lee's fate. She was most thoroughly dead, killed by Domi, and buried in an unmarked grave. It was decorated by bouquets of wildflowers picked by her dupe, Auerbach. Only in the past week had the man been released from a detention cell. He was free on a form of parole, permitted to venture outside the redoubt only with an escort. Every day, he visited Beth Lee's grave. Bridget wasn't sure why he did so. He had been the woman's pawn, seduced into participating in a conspiracy to kill Cain and Grant, foolishly believing Beth Lee's promise that Bridget would be spared. Apparently, Beth Lee had manipulated him by vowing that once Grant and Cain were out of the way, Cerberus would be his personal stud farm, where he would be serviced on demand by all of the female personnel. But that was only speculation, derived primarily from the scornful reasoning provided by Wegman, the redoubt's engineer, who had never liked Auerbach from the outset. Auerbach himself had offered up very little in the way of a motive. He had ably served DeFore, the installation's medic, for quite some time. He had never displayed any aberrant behavior until Lakesh brought Bethlehem Rauch into Cerberus as part of his ill-conceived plan to turn the redoubt from a sanctuary into a colony. Bridget removed the empty magazine from the butt of the Ivor Johnson and slapped in a full one. She aimed the pistol at the target again, this time with a fierce, conscious effort to see only a paper outline, not Ambika's blue-eyed, triumphant sneer. Squeezing the trigger, she fired only 4 rounds before relaxing her finger. She gazed toward the target and made a wordless utterance of disgust. She saw no new bullet holes. Every one of the 4 shots had missed completely. She contemplated substituting Beth Lee's delicate, exotic face for Ambika's, but gave up the whole endeavor as a wasted effort, not to mention a bit on the unhealthy side. On a psychological level, Bridget felt no unfinished business existed between her and Beth Lee, and therefore imagining her as a target wouldn't make much difference. With Ambika, as much as she detested the emotion, she felt the thirst for revenge. Bridget policed the area, picking up the shell casings and taking down the target. She crossed the plateau to the peak. Recessed into the base was the massive vanadium alloy sector, which opened like an accordion, one section folding over another. It was partially open, and she strode through. Entering the dimly lit main corridor, Bridget punched in the code on the keypad, not bothering to watch the sector close. Painted on the wall near the pad was a large, luridly colored illustration of a 3-headed black hound. Fire and blood gushed between yellow fangs, and the crimson eyes glared bright and baleful. Underneath it, in ornate Gothic script, was written, Cerberus. Once, when Bridget asked about the artist, Lakesh opined that one of the original military personnel assigned to the redoubt had rendered the painting sometime prior to the new cost. Although he couldn't be positive, he figured Corporal Mooney was the artist, since its exaggerated exuberance seemed right out of the comic books he was obsessed with collecting. Lakesh had never considered having it removed. For one thing, the paints were indelible, and for another, it was Corporal Mooney's form of immortality. Besides, the image of Cerberus, the guardian of the gates of hell, represented a visual symbol of the work to which Lakesh had devoted his life. Bridget strode along the wide passageway beneath great curving ribs of metal that supported the high rock roof. She walked down the corridor past the vehicle depot and workroom and entered an open doorway. The overhead fluorescent fixtures flooded the armory with a harsh white light. The big room was stacked nearly to the ceiling with wooden crates and boxes. Many of the crates were stenciled with the legend, Property U.S. Army. Glass-fronted gun cases lined the 4 walls, containing automatic assault rifles, many makes and models of subguns, and dozens of semi-automatic blasters. Heavy assault weaponry occupied the north wall, bazookas, tripod-mounted M249 machine guns, mortars, and rocket launchers. She placed the Ivor Johnson automatic back in its case, glancing quickly at the 2 black figures standing near the rear wall. Cain's and Grant's magistrate body armor was mounted on metal frameworks that resembled grim, silent sentries. Leaving the armory, Brigid continued on down the 20-foot-wide corridor to the Central Operations Complex, the nerve center of Cerberus Redoubt. The room was long, with high vaulted ceilings. Consoles of dials, switches, buttons, and flickering lights ran the length of the walls. Circuits hummed, needles twitched, and monitor screens displayed changing columns of numbers. She gave only a glance to the big Mercator relief map of the world that spanned nearly one entire wall. Spots of light winked on almost every continent, and thin, glowing lines networked across the countries, like a web spun by a radioactive spider. The map delineated all the geophysical alterations caused by the nuke cost and pinpointed the locations of the functioning gateway units all over the world. The control complex had 5 dedicated and 8 shared subprocessors, all linked to the mainframe behind the far wall. 200 years ago, it had been the most advanced model ever built, carrying experimental, error-correcting microchips of such a tiny size that they even reacted to quantum fluctuations. Biochip technology had been employed when it was built, protein molecules sandwiched between microscopic glass and metal circuits. The information contained in the main database might not have been the sum total of all humankind's knowledge, but not for lack of trying. Any bit, byte, or shred of information that had ever been digitized was only a few keystrokes or mouse clicks away. On the opposite side of the center, an anteroom held the MatTrans unit, its 8-foot-tall, translucent, brown-hued armaglass walls enclosing the jump chamber. DeFore stood over Lakesh at one of the comp terminals. She was stocky and buxom, and her bronze skin made her ash-blonde hair in intricate braids stand out starkly. As usual, she wore the white, form-fitting bodysuit that was the usual attire of the Redoubt inhabitants. Her full-lipped, brown-eyed face was composed and didn't reveal anything that might have been on her mind. Lakesh looked up at Brigid's approach. He resembled an animated cadaver with astigmatism. Thick glasses covered his roomy blue eyes. A hearing aid was attached to the right earpiece. His sparse, ash-colored hair was disheveled, and despite the appearance of advanced age, he looked better than he should have.
What are you reading on the biolinks?
Nothing. A cold fist of fear closed around her heart, but she kept her expression level and steady.
Explain.
How do you explain nothing? All of their signals vanished at the same time.
The fist in Brigid's chest relaxed somewhat, and she glanced at the console.
So it's more likely an uplink or transmission failure than a simultaneous cessation of their vital signs?
At least that's what we've been telling ourselves. We won't know for sure until the system's diagnostic is done.
Bry raised his copper-curled head from the master op station. A round-shouldered man of small stature, his white bodysuit bagged on him.
I'm 90% certain that's the reason. Maybe caused by weather conditions. Even solar flares are a strong possibility at this time of year. Or the ComSat has simply relayed its last signal from the subcutaneous transponders. It's been in orbit for over 2 centuries, you know.
Mr. Bry, it isn't necessary to point to age every time we have a minor glitch with the ComSat or the Vela. How will your constant harping on how old the satellites are solve our present problem?
2 spots of red appeared on Bry's cheeks, and to stave off an argument, Brigid waved a hand and stepped between the 2 men's line of sight.
I think it's best to assume we've temporarily lost the signals through some kind of outside interference. Kane said to give them 3 days, and the 3rd day isn't over yet by half.
Lakesh's shoulders slumped wearily, and he knuckled his deeply grooved forehead.
Technology is like a chain. 1 weak link and we're all back to the Stone Age.
No one responded to his sour observation. The world from which he came was one where technology had been taken for granted. Malfunctioning or worn-out parts could be replaced. Transatlantic telephone lines and computer networks decreased vast distances, and television kept people informed of events shaping their lives. For all the other exiles in the Redoubt, technology remained an arcane and eldritch set of sciences not too far removed from magic. For people raised in the Vills, technology was doled out piecemeal, its use reserved for the elite.
Bry, what about the radio signals we've been intercepting from Sumeriumville?
Bry lifted his downsloping shoulders in a shrug.
The same. The Sumeriumville medical division is asking for aid from the other Vills to help them fight the epidemic.
Epidemic? The outbreak has gotten worse?
Yep. It was confined to the Bayou country around Lafayette, but it appears to be spreading.
That fast? We didn't pick up the first reports until 2 weeks ago.
That's only when we were able to patch into the comweb and listen in. The outbreak could have been reported long before that.
Only recently, Lakesh and Bry had created a communication scanner with Vil radio frequencies and channels that involved using the redoubt satellite uplinks. So far, it had worked smoothly, but now that the commsat was down, so was Cerberus's ability to eavesdrop.
Have you picked up anything regarding specific symptoms?
Bry gestured to a stack of spreadsheets on a nearby desk.
That's the record of the last communications exchange before we lost the commsat signals. I ran it through an interpolations program, but I haven't had the chance to look it over.
DeFore sat down at the desk and began thumbing through the sheaf of papers, a line of concentration creasing her forehead. A constant fear in the Vils revolved around the outbreak of designer viruses, bioengineered contagions cooked up before the nuke cost and stored in hidden facilities. Biowarfare had not played a large role in the final war, mainly because the global nuclear conflagration had done its work too well. Bacteria and germs were scorched off the face of the Earth along with the humans they had been created to infect.
Lafayette, seems like I read something about that region.
Lakesh's eyes narrowed thoughtfully behind the lenses of his glasses.
I confess it strikes a faint chord of recognition with me too, but I can't immediately place it.
Brigid seated herself in front of the terminal and switched it on. Lakesh swiveled around in his chair to face her.
Access the Overproject Excalibur file. Keyword Enterprise Eternity. See what you come up with.
She nodded, fingers flying over the keyboard.
Do you think the epidemic in Louisiana has something to do with Overproject Excalibur experiments?
I think we can both agree that anything is possible, particularly with all the X factors arising out of the totality concept researchers. We've certainly contended with their residue enough times.
Oh my God. No.
Bridget turned away from the screen to see the woman gazing wide-eyed at the spreadsheets, her finger pressed down on a line of copy.
What is it?
This last communication was between a field team and the Sumerianville Medical Division. It lists the symptoms of the disease.
What are they?
High fever, swelling of the lymph nodes, massive tissue infection, hemorrhaging of the lungs, complete shutdown of the respiratory system.
Sounds like some kind of a plague.
DeFore lifted her face from the paper, her expression stricken. Fear swirled in the dark depths of her eyes.
Not just a plague. It's the plague. The Black Death.
As an archivist, Doyle didn't believe in demons or zombies. As a self-proclaimed conjure man, Vailey did. Neither man had much choice but to stick to the convictions ingrained in them from a lifetime of conditioning. What the three magistrates who had accompanied Doyle from Sumerianville into the guts of the bayou believed was anybody's guess. Vailey sat on his sagging stoop in front of his clapboard shack and smoked a filthy hand-rolled cigarette. He looked very old, and his dark brown skin resembled a leathery chocolate bar. Doyle eyed the bleached alligator skull nailed above the doorway and ruminated on the old man's tedious, non-specific story about a horror forgotten by men for nearly 200 years, monstrously resurrected from the black, lost time of Skydark. Doyle's own thoughts were as far from supernatural menaces as the thoughts of a man could be. His mind, though dark, was far more materialistic in nature. He was on a mission from Baron Sumerium, and he couldn't afford the time to stand and listen to folk tales. But he couldn't afford to alienate the Conjure Man either, since he claimed to know the source of the epidemic sweeping through the bayou and creeping into the baronial lands. Being a mid-grade archivist in the Sumerianville Historical Division, Doyle knew he should have been interested in the tale that had creaked out of the old man's wattled throat. But his field of expertise was medical history, not Cajun legends. Archivists were not historians, as generally believed. They were primarily data entry techs, albeit ones with high security clearances. Mid-grade archivists like Doyle were researchers. A vast amount of pre-dark historical information had survived the Nukecost, particularly documents stored in underground vaults. Tons of it, in fact. Everything from novels to encyclopedias to magazines printed on coated stock that survived just about anything. Much more data was digitized, stored on computer diskettes, usually government documents. The primary duty of archivists was not to simply record pre-dark history, but to revise, rewrite, and oftentimes completely disguise it. The political causes leading to the new cost were well known. They were major parts of the dogma, the doctrine, the articles of faith, and they had to be accurately recorded for posterity. Doyle was engaged in researching the effects of biowarfare in pre-dark days when the first reports of the disease out in the swamplands reached Sumeriumville. The Ville administrator's first course of action was to do nothing. No Ville citizen cared about what happened in or to the Outlands. For many decades after the nuke cost, the Gulf Coast had been all but submerged by bomb-triggered tidal waves. After the drowning seas had finally receded, almost all of Louisiana, Alabama, and Georgia had become one vast steaming lagoon. Therefore, the reports of disease percolating in the tainted, simmering wetlands elicited little surprise and even less sympathy for the people who eked out a marginal existence in them. The bayous were essentially under a form of permanent quarantine anyway. Technically, the swamps fell under the jurisdiction of Baron Sumerium, but they were so difficult to navigate, their citizens were left to their own devices. Very rarely did the magistrates venture into them. However, when reliable reports of the disease's symptoms reached Sumeriumville, the administrators began tracking the epidemic and discovered that the most recent outbreaks had occurred within 70 miles of the Ville proper. The plague was approaching like ripples caused by a pebble dropped into a pond. After weeks of ignoring the situation and additional weeks of discussing it, the administrators decided to look for the area where the pebble had been dropped. The first team dispatched into the Outlands made regular reports for the first few days. They described finding settlements full of corpses, bodies lying about in advanced stages of decomposition, but untouched by scavenger birds or animals. The settlements and the bodies therein were burned as per procedure. The reports made almost casual mentions of seeing rats near the settlements. After a day or two, the rodent reports ceased being casual and became the primary topic. The team saw thousands of rats, hordes of squealing, chittering rodents making bold forays into the team's base camp, even dropping from trees onto them. Amid the sightings of rats, glimpses of small, dark people with scar tissue around their eyes were mentioned. They were just as furtive as the rats, dodging and flitting among the swamp shadows. Anyone born in Sumeriumville had heard of the Swampies, a breed apart from the Cajuns, but who coexisted with them in the bayous. Rumor had it they were muties, but since their own enclaves were so deep in the tropical wilderness, no one knew for certain. What was known for certain was that the reports from the field team stopped abruptly and with a chilling finality. Doyle was the man charged with the task of collating all the information in the reports and producing a diagnosis. The answer was so obvious, he was surprised none of the Ville administrators or the senior archivist reached the same conclusion. The bubonic plague, the Black Death of the Middle Ages, so called from the blackened skin eruptions that broke out on those afflicted. It was transmitted by sick rats, sometimes by bites of the fleas carried by the rodents, sometimes by the bites of the rats themselves. Doyle also triangulated the spread of the plague and came up with a pretty solid set of coordinates from which it appeared to spring. When he presented his findings, he presumed one of two things would happen. He would receive a small material reward, like an expanded food ration card, or more likely, his superiors wouldn't acknowledge his contribution at all. Not in his wildest imaginings did he picture being assigned to lead another field team into the Outlands. There was no point in lodging a protest or trying to explain that as a Ville-bred academic, he was singularly unsuited for such a mission. He had come to the attention of the Baron, and that was all that was necessary. In the company of three hard-contact magistrates, Doyle had first stopped at the small Ville of Brampton, a fairly typical Gulf Coast pest hole. Nestled on the edge of the sprawling wetlands, Brampton was indeed another in a long line of shit Villes. Doyle had been told the place was nothing to get excited about, and after they arrived, he'd agreed wholeheartedly, but he hadn't expected an open-air charnel house. It was a Ville populated only by the dead and dying. Young and old, men and women, all felled by the same sweep of the scythe. They lay on porches and on streets, mouths open in silent screams of agony, bodies swollen and covered with pustules. The ground was moist with blood coughed up from hemorrhaging lungs. They didn't find any rats or signs of the first wreck team, but they found one survivor. The woman lived long enough to helpfully direct them to a conjure man who, according to local lore, knew just about everything. If anyone knew about the fate of the first team, he would. So, after a day of crossing the bayous in a swamp wag, Doyle stood sweating in the hazy greenish light, one foot propped up on the porch of the weather-beaten shack. A simple structure, the aged construct appeared to be more ruin than secure dwelling. A series of blacked-out windows, a tilted chimney oozing an upward spiral of wood smoke, and a curiously flat tar-paper roof. Once, the sickly green house might have stood tall and defiant among the grassy tendrils that passed for ground cover in the back waterways surrounding it, but now it looked as if the walls had grown up whole from the damp earth instead of being built by human hands. On either side of the Conjure Man's dwelling rose cypress and mangrove trees, the branches smothered by Spanish moss, drooping from every limb like the beards of old men. He stood in front of the wizened Veli and waited for him to wind up his convoluted tale. Veli had ducked all questions about the first team dispatched from Samariumville, only smiling cryptically.
"The old ones are gone, but they cannot die. The first men turned upon them, and mankind conquered. So long ago that not but legends come to us through the ages. Yet even as man drove them forth into the wastelands of the ancient world, they only heed, knowing that when man grew weak and forgot them, they could return. One of them did return, back in the days when the sky be black."
Doyle waved away the cloud of pungent smoke stinging his eyes.
"Do you mean the nuclear winter, the sky dark?"
"Oui. My great-grandmama, a powerful Hungan, returned him to the sepulchre of the earth. He been laying there now, not dead, only asleep, waiting for his time to come round again."
"Where is this sepulchre?"
"The plague grows from it. It is no good place. Let hidden things rest. Best not disturb what is hidden in the earth."
"Are you talking about an Indian burial mound?"
"Indians. Who spoke of the Indians? There have been more than Indians in this country. In them old times, strange things happen here. I have heard the tales of my people handed down from generation to generation. And my people were here long before yours."
Doyle did not refute that. He couldn't, even if he wanted to. He palmed away sweat from his forehead and turned his head to glance at the three mags standing behind him, hot and miserable in their body armor. The diffused sunshine struck dim highlights on the molded chest pieces and shoulder pads. The only color anywhere about the black armor was the red duty badge discs affixed to the left pectoral. They carried their helmets under their polycarbonate enclosed arms. Flandry, Raider, and Brackett were all of a type, tall, rangy, and as tough as whalebone. By contrast, Doyle was of medium height and build, with the beginnings of a paunch. His brown hair receded from his high forehead. He couldn't properly seat his rectangular-lensed, wire-framed eyeglasses on the bridge of his beaky nose because they always slid out of position on a layer of sweat. He continually had to push them back. He sensed the mag's impatience. He knew they silently wondered why he wasted so much time and probably what seemed to them an inordinate amount of courtesy on a slagging outlander.
"How far is this so-called sepulchre?"
"You got no business there, vil man."
"I'll be the one to make that assessment."
The effect of that simple statement on Veli was nothing short of electrifying. He recoiled, and his dark face went ashy. His black eyes flared. The cigarette dropped from his lips and lay smoldering between his feet.
"Sacre, no. Don't do that. Day is a curse. My grandmama told me."
"Told you what?"
"I cannot speak. I am sworn to silence. But believe me when I say better had you cut your throat than to break in that fucking sepulchre."
"God damn it, tell us where it is."
"I cannot tell you that. I am sworn to silence at the cause of this all."
He fumbled inside his ragged shirt and withdrew a small crucifix hanging by a leather thong. Doyle glanced at it curiously, at the feathers and beads attached to it.
"What's the Zange?"
"You would call them angels. Every member of my family has sworn an oath on such a cross since the time of Mama Minuet. The sepulchre is the thing so dark. It is to risk eternal damnation, even for my own people to visit there."
Flandry's Sin Eater sprang from its holster into his hand. He stepped forward, putting the barrel against the side of the old man's head.
"I've had enough of this shit. Tell us or die!"
Veli gazed into the hollow bore of the blaster and then up into Flandry's face.
"I do not fear death, child."
Doyle's throat constricted. He had seen plenty of corpses, bloated by disease, on the trip to this point in the bayous. but he had never seen a man chilled. He realized he did not want to see it either. He wasn't accustomed to dealing with mags, nor were mags accustomed to dealing with archivists. Although their respective divisions were only a level apart in the administrative monolith, they might as well have come from different planets. The taciturn Flandry in particular scared him, with his pale eyes that seemed to stare right through him, silently judging him and finding him wanting.
We ask you this question because of the sickness. We may be able to cure it.
The sickness is no more than the old one's dreams. But my oath say nothing of what is writ down.
You have a written account of what you know?
Oui. The old priest taught my people their letters. We may be outcasts, but we be no literates.
You've got this account?
Veli grinned, showing off his toothless gums, and stiffly heaved himself up from the stoop, completely oblivious to the blaster pointed at him.
Long time ago, my great-grandfather write it all down, about what happened here in the days of old Lafitte. Wait here.
He shuffled into the shack, and Doyle heard him rummaging about. Within a minute, he returned with a number of dingy leaves of wood pulp paper, bound with twine, held between his gnarled fingers. Without preamble, he shoved them into Doyle's hands.
Here, read them. It is my grandpapa's tale of his grandpapa's traffic with an old one. The story will not save you, but at least you will know what snatches your souls.
What do you want for these papers?
If you read them and not believe what they say, then you will pay a very high price. Everything has its price.
Which way do we go to find this sepulcher?
That way, to the southeast. Follow the stream. You come to sepulcher by and by. Watch for the rats and the keepers.
Keepers?
Veli traced lines around his eyes with a fingertip.
The minions are the old one. They still watch over the sepulcher, though they can't break the seal. And now they watch for you and wait for you to do it for them. Now I got no more to say to you. If when you break the seal, be back here by and by.
Flandry still had his sin-eater unholstered. He obviously wanted to bid goodbye to the Conjure Man with a bullet, but when Doyle turned and walked toward the swamp wag, he reluctantly leathered his weapon and fell into step behind him. The swamp wag resembled a wheeled boat. The six huge tires held it nearly 8 feet off the ground, and only by climbing the small metal ladders affixed to the hull could the open control compartment be reached. Its 3-inch-thick armor plate bore streaks and flakes of rust. Doyle had no idea how old the vehicle might be, but he guessed its manufacture dated well before the nuke cost. They had requisitioned it at a border outpost between official Samariumville territory and the Outlands. The wag was a miserable conveyance, but it was preferable to slogging through the mudflats and cypress groves on foot. Raider took the controls, firing up the diesel engines. Smoke spouted from the exhaust in dark gray palls, blending in with the heat haze. The massive tires spun, throwing rooster tails of foul water and mud in back-parching sprays. Because the buggy operated like a land vehicle and a boat, Raider took the rudder bar to steer it when the wag entered the deep water, the inflated tires providing buoyancy. They had been underway only a few minutes, following Bailey's vague directions, splashing and bouncing along the bank of the shallow stream, when blurs of motion overhead caught their eyes. Small shapes appeared, scurrying over the intertwining branches of sycamore and cypress trees. Racket glared upwards.
Fucking rats!
All of them had seen rats before, particularly down in the Tartarus pits, the cheap labor quarters of Samariumville. But these were the size of house cats, with fiery red eyes and snow-white coats.
Albinism. Common down here, I'm told.
Flandry unleathered his sin-eater, took aim, and pressed the trigger. The blaster bucked and roared, gouting flame. The fusillade of 9mm rounds sheared through the tree limbs, splitting bark and shredding leaves. Two of the rats burst apart in greasy sprays of viscera. Droplets of blood spattered down onto the deck.
God damn you! You want to let every swampy between here and the Missip know we're here?
Shit, like that old Peace Outland shit said. They know we're here already. We can take on some piss-poor swamp muties.
Yeah, like the first team did.
Flandry didn't respond, but he slid his sin-eater back into its holster. Veli remained sitting on the stoop until he lost sight of the arrogant Ville men. From the open doorway, a man's shape moved closer.
You did well, old man. All those years of baiting hooks finally paid off. You fulfilled your part of the Master's prophecy.
Stiffly, Vailey pushed himself up and went inside the dimly lit interior of the house. The strong, wild smell of wood smoke wafted across his nostrils, and he struggled not to sneeze. The only illumination came from the roaring flames in the fireplace on the far back wall. The room was sparsely furnished with crude wooden chairs of different sizes, a faded print sofa, shelves filled with crumbling books and jars, and two end tables that looked to be as old as the house itself. Two swampies stood on either end of the sagging sofa, their eyes glittering in the pits of scar tissue surrounding the sockets. Dark-skinned, stocky, and solid of build, well under medium height, they wore curving Kaiser knives at their hips. Grimy, calloused hands without fingernails held small, crude crossbows pointed at the bound and gagged, naked girl seated on the couch. The quarrels themselves were less than 6 inches long, but Vailey knew the brown, tarry substance on the sharp points was a poison so deadly that even a scratch could bring death. The girl eyed the crossbows fearlessly, scornfully. She was as darkly complexioned as the swampies, but her skin was much smoother, fine-pored and flawless in texture. Glistening pinpoints of perspiration shone on her forehead, between her firm breasts and on her flat stomach. Her black hair tumbled in thickly braided dreadlocks, draping her body to below her waist. Her full lips were parted to accommodate the dirty bandana tied around her jaws, and her slender arms were bound at the small of her back. Her indigo eyes seethed with hatred of the two swampies.
Are you all right, child?
She jerked her head in a nod of repressed fury, the veins and tendons standing out on the slim column of her throat.
Your granddaughter is fine. We didn't harm her, just like we promised.
Bailey's mouth twisted in a contemptuous smirk.
I've known you all my life, La Grande. You too, Crefort. I know your fathers. None of them could keep promises. Why should I expect anything different from you?
We serve different gods, Conjure Man.
Casually, Legrand reached over and untied the knot in the girl's gag. She spit it from her mouth, shaking her head, the dreadlocks flying. She glared at Legrand, then at Crofu.
Do you dung beetles have any idea of the wrath you called upon yourselves? Upon your entire misbegotten clan?
You haven't been invested yet, slut. The law haven't recognized you.
She drew herself up and stared in regal haughtiness at the swampies.
Mother Midnight lives in me. I carry her blood. I carry her powers. How dare you, Moodspawn, question me, let alone lay hands upon me and my grandfather.
Bailey saw anger flash in the eyes of both swampies, and he interposed his body between them and his granddaughter.
Enough, Esta. We did what they wanted and sent the veal man to the sepulchre. What will be, will be. Legrand, I know you want to be back on your way before the moon rises and darkness falls.
We can afford to wait a little while. Though the stars are right for the old one to return, we must see what awaits him upon his awakening. As for you, girl, Mama Minuit was a seer. If you have her powers, you will tell us what is to come.
I tell you nothing, Tong Man.
Crofu shifted his crossbow, the sticky point aiming at Vailey's heart.
Then you'll watch your grandfather die.
Neither Vailey nor Esther spoke or moved. After a stretched-out moment, she nodded slightly, shoulders sagging in resignation.
My hands must be freed.
Crofu, cut her loose. Old man, if she plays us false, you will die.
Crofu used his Kaiser knife to slice through the rawhide thongs binding Esther's wrists. She rubbed them briefly to restore circulation, then slid from the sofa, crouching very close to the fire, so close to the licking tongues of the flames that perspiration began literally rivering down her naked body. For long, quiet minutes, Esther stared into the fireplace.
You want to look down the road, yes?
That's right. Moving forward.
Such glimpses may be dangerous. There is always a price exacted by the Lua.
All they have to do is ask, and the request will be met.
The woman turned her face away from the dancing flames, angling an eyebrow at the swampies.
That is not what I meant. You are not aware of the one true price. No man can be. But that which you worship is not a man. You need his protection, his guarantees, his good favor.
Esther closed her eyes, her entire body seeming to relax in a posture of prayer. She made motions with her hands, intricate, peculiar, circular gestures.
The flames show me. They speak to me. They reveal the road to me. The earth burns. The world turns. The sky is flame. The ground is ash and steel like a parasite. The cockroach, the legend, and the meat. The old one endures. The old one survives. But so does man.
As he always has. As he always will.
How many times will man destroy himself, following the road laid out by his maker, exercising what he believes in his heart to be free will, and yet keeping to the pathways chosen eons ago by the old ones? There are always two paths to follow, two choices to be made, the do and the do not, up or down, in or out, one way or the other. Such is the curse of man.
Yet there are those who know otherwise. They see the right direction, like the old ones.
The woman turned as if to look at him, yet her eyes were still closed tight. Her firelight-sculpted face was unreadable, unknowable.
I have seen the future in all of its terrible colored glory. I do not like what I see.
What do you see of the old one? What do you see of him?
They come for him. They come. They come from within.
Who comes?
They come across the sky and back again. Across the world over and over. A patchwork. A joining of lands. Tread through the needle, the pathways hidden. They travel by lightning, by thunder, through the magic of the storm. Earnest in the caves. The energy electric. Worse. The energy forbidden. Explosive. Destructive. Yet they still come. They still come.
Who travels? How many?
There are two brothers. Brothers in all but blood. Brothers in arms and in souls. They will seek two women who possess healing knowledge. They will come from the pathways, hidden, and arrive at the forbidden place of dead science.
A stealthy step padded outside the door, but neither Swampy looked away from Esther.
Can they be stopped?
These things are governed by immutable laws. The Loa enforce the laws. I do not altogether understand them myself. No human can. Events must work out to either salvation or damnation.
Esther drew in a breath and leaned back from the flames. She opened her eyes and stared unfocusedly at the fire.
That is all I see. Two women, two men following the path invisible.
The woman's body slumped, her head bowed, the dreadlocks coiling on the floor like snakes.
What's that noise?
I hear nothing.
You can't hear that? That sound like footsteps, right after she stopped talking.
I hear nothing. My eyes may be poor, but my ears are clear.
The Loa have many servants.
Krofu aimed his crossbow at her bare back.
And they're about to lose another one.
No!
Bailey flung himself at the Swampy. The string of the crossbow twanged, and the quarrel drove into the old man's chest. He fell half on, half off the sofa, clawing at the shaft sprouting from his body. From the doorway, a black and sleek shape hurtled toward Krofu, who had just enough time and presence of mind to turn around before 115 pounds of growling animal flesh fell upon him. Krofu fell over on his hip, grit pressing into his cheek, the smell of the huge mastiff's breath filling his face and his mind as the dog thrust a long snout up under his bearded chin. Bone white flashed in the flickering firelight as the dog's mouth sought the right spot to strike. Spittle from the mastiff sprayed Krofu's neck. In shock, Legrand watched the rise and fall of the dog's heavy breathing as Krofu's vertebrae splintered between the animal's huge jaws. Esther snapped her fingers at the dog and it stopped chewing. It backed away, but the great head sunk as it lapped once at the blood forming a pool around Krofu's head.
The Loa have many servants. He is one of them. The price they exacted for my services was the life of one of you.